This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Now you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. And I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Got an email from Portland Cop Watch this morning from Dan Handelman. Here's part of it. It says the police held a news conference, which, as pointed out by Dennis Thoreau in the Mercury article, was designed to paint a picture of a man who wanted the police to kill him. If you have the fortitude to watch the video, it's not on-screen graphic, but there's a lot of Mr. Hatch cursing and a fusillade of gunshots at the end. He writes, "What amazes me is how the Bureau describes the officers shooting from 14 yards when the magic number they always talk about is 21 feet or half that distance. So even if they had beanbags or tasers drawn, they chose to use deadly force instead." And Dan writes, "I went out to Adventist parking lot the other morning. You can see on the video that there's fencing all around. It seems that they could have used that to contain the suspect and let him wear himself out. Predicted police response, he could have used the phone receiver to shoot at people from inside the fence." The Community Police Relations Committee didn't talk about the shooting when Bharati Arthuri, the mayor's police advisor, got up to head the news conference, but only after it was mentioned to them in public input. Their responses were interesting, including this new mantra of wanting to keep the investigation process clean. That's why they released information about Mr. Hatch's criminal record, I'm sure, and some strong words from community members about how this reverberates like an earthquake when this kind of thing happens. And Dan writes, "I won't make any predictions about the grand jury, but let's just say that the combination of information the police have already put out makes me feel like they believe this is justifiable. I wonder if the Department of Justice went to the scene to investigate. The man was clearly in some kind of mental health crisis." And the article, which you can find at portlandmercury.com, says, "Merle Michael Hatch was holding a busted, stolen black telephone receiver, 8 inches long and 2 inches wide. When he ran at a pack of Portland cops, he'd been swearing at and goading from 80 yards away. He clearly wasn't in his right mind, and he didn't have a gun. But Hatch never got any closer than 40 or so feet falling to the ground when those three officers unloaded their weapons into him outside Adventist Medical Center on Sunday night." And there's more to that article. It got my attention in part. Well, it got my attention because of things like Dickie Dow and Kendra James and Keaton Otis and... this guy can't say good things about him. He was in between jail, but this is another person shot dead, and it doesn't look to me like he needed to be shot dead. The talk of tasers seems to me is out of line because you can't taser at 42 feet. So... another reason it got my attention is because last week I went and saw Alien Boy, the movie about the killing of James Chassie, and I strongly urge you to go see it. It was a very good documentary. It tells you about this person that I never knew. My partner knew him, who was quite the force on the Portland punk scene. Apparently was known to Kurt Cobain, and who was killed by Portland police, and there's been a lot said about it, but you know, there are similarities. There was the painting of him as a criminal. There was a talk of the person who was killed having several convictions for drugs, and there was an attempt to smear him with breadcrumbs, saying that they were bits of cocaine, that sort of thing. It shows that nothing has changed. Alien Boy, about the death of James Chassie, known to some as Jim Jim, is running February 24th, I think that's Sunday, through the 28th, down at Cinema 21, 21st and Gleason in Northwest Portland. I strongly urge you to get a friend, especially a friend who says that, oh, the police are just doing the best they can around here, and go see that film. And so long as I'm pointing out some things that need to get done, I would say that KBOO, thriving as we are, could definitely use some computers. I was just working on printing out my script, my notes for the program, and you know, we could really do with some flat screens around here. And flat screens have been around long enough that probably some of you have a good used one that you can let us have. We need a little more desk space than we have in places, and it would really help. So we're at 20 Southeast 8th. Call the front desk just after the show sometime, won't you, if you have a flat screen that you can make available to us, or just come on down with it. If you want to find this program on KBOO, pull up kboo.fm. KBOO is easy enough to find with a web search if you forget about the FM part. And use the search bar for Press Watch, and the audio should come up automatically. That'll be about 15 minutes after I'm back off the air. And furthermore, you'll want to stay tuned because we have a big morning lined up for you. We've got Pairfogging coming up next. And the question is, who killed Pope John Paul I? Not going to let that one fall into the memory hole. You know that's going to be a dynamite interview with Pairfogging, so stay tuned for that. Coming up in just 22 minutes now. Been going around with my Geiger counter. I've noticed that some counts have recently been up a little bit. Got 32 counts per minute from a tree at Southwest Washington and 6th the other day. And it's hard to say, you know, exactly what that means, of course. But the reason I have the Geiger counter is to just get an idea of what the levels are. But 32 is a little higher than I've picked up over the last couple of years. Generally, my high readings have been more like 24 counts per minute on exposed surfaces. And of course, I'm looking for fallout from the Fukushima explosions. 100 counts per minute is the equivalent to 1 microsievert. So we're talking about a third of a microsievert, or a third of a tenth of a millirem. I guess that would be 0.03 millirem, something like that. So just to let you know, still sniffing around for that radioactivity, and the crisis at Fukushima is far from over. The cores continue to heat and to melt down. And of course, the all of the rods for the stored fuel pool at Reactor 4 are still in danger of falling 100 feet to the ground. Or is it 40 feet? I forget. Far enough to create a worldwide mess, that's for sure. All right, going to headlines. General strike paralyzes Greece. Millions of workers have walked off the job in Greece today in a one-day strike against fiscal austerity. This from Radio Havana, Cuba. It was the latest in a series of actions against the wage cuts and tax hikes imposed as a condition of Greece's international bailout. Tens of thousands of people marched on the Greek parliament in Athens, and the country's first general strike this year. The job action caused massive disruption to flights, ferries, and hospital services in Greece. According to news reports, the Greek nationwide strike forced airport authorities to scrap or reschedule dozens of flights, while hospitals operated on reduced staffing. Ships were to remain docked in Greece throughout the day, disrupting ferry services to nearby islands. And although most public transport was running, albeit with delays, all buses and train services reported major disruptions. Doctors, lawyers, and teachers took part in the protest action organized by private sector union GSEE and the public sector ADEDY union. The Greek leftist party Syriza, which heads the opposition, is targeting the coalition government of conservative Prime Minister Antonis Samaras. Greece's three-party government insists there is no alternative to the harsh austerity program demanded by the country's creditors in return for vital loans to stave off bankruptcy. Successive cuts to salaries and pensions over the past 3 years have angered Greeks, who have frequently taken to the streets to demonstrate their frustration. And once again, that's from radiohc.cu. Pull it up yourself and have a look at that and other articles. Now I want to talk about the Arctic sea ice emergency and the clathrate gun. Let me tell you what the clathrate gun is first, in case you don't already know. The clathrate gun is the hypothesis that should temperatures rise sufficiently, should a tipping point be passed in global climate change and global warming, the gigatons of frozen and locked methane in the Arctic, under the sea, locked into the soils, will come bursting to the surface. Clathrates are pretty dramatic when you see them for what they can do. It's a sort of ice that is formed with formed under pressure with methane and water, and it's not a stable compound, and so once it passes, it only forms under certain pressure and below a certain temperature. So once the temperature is passed, it can break up and float to the surface where it is underwater, and frequently bursts into flame when it does. Methane is a very efficient global warming actor, much more efficient than carbon dioxide. It tends to break down into carbon dioxide, but as I said, there are gigatons of this stuff, and not just in clathrate forms, in the Arctic. And the idea is, should that tipping point be passed, then the methane will come out and cause a very rapid increase in global warming. So an explosion, literally. And so that's the clathrate gun. And actually, we've been talking about that on this program for more than a decade. Well, no, I'd say almost a decade. I remember talking about it just about 10 years ago. And there's been talk back and forth about whether this is possible and whether that tipping point could be reached. Well, I've been looking at, I was looking at a map composed by superimposing methane readings for January, for last month, over the areas in the Arctic which melted off. As you may know, about half the ice cap melted off over last summer. And if the methane readings are mapped over that, you can see that wherever the ice was missing, there is a very high reading of methane. This is very bad news. So turning to an article on thinkprogress.org/climate, which I thank Andrew for, KBOO's Andrew for turning me on to, Why the Arctic Sea Ice Death Spiral Matters, by Neva Necropolis with Kevin McKinney. They write, in the past week, the Arctic ice sea cover reached an all-time low. Several, and this is was written a couple of months ago, several weeks before previous records, several weeks before the end of the melting season. Okay, it was written 3 or 4 months ago. The long-term decline of Arctic sea ice has been incredibly fast, and at this point, a sudden reversal of events doesn't seem likely. The question no longer seems to be, will we see an ice-free Arctic, but how soon will we see it? By running the Arctic Sea Ice blog for the past 3 years, they write, they've learned much about the importance of Arctic sea ice. With the help of Kevin McKinney, this piece, Arctic Sea Ice, became a recurrent feature on planet Earth around 47 million years ago. Since the start of the current ice age, about 2.5 million years ago, the Arctic Ocean has been completely covered with sea ice. Only during interglacials, like the one we are in now, does some of the sea ice melt during the summer, when the top of the planet is oriented a bit more towards the sun and receives large amount of sunlight for several summer months. Even then, when winter starts, the ice-free portion of the Arctic Ocean freezes over again with a new layer of sea ice. Since the dawn of human civilization 5,000 to 8,000 years ago, and I would just have to comment that it's been a little longer than that, but we'll go with their estimate. This annual ebb and flow of melting and freezing Arctic sea ice has been more or less consistent. There were periods when more ice melted during summer and periods when less melted. However, a radical shift has occurred in recent times. Ever since satellites allowed a detailed view of the Arctic and its ice, a pronounced decrease in summer sea ice cover has been observed, with this year setting a new record low. When the IPCC released its fourth assessment report in 2007, it was generally thought that the Arctic would become ice-free somewhere near the end of this century. But changes in the Arctic have progressed at such speed that most experts now think 2030 might see an ice-free Arctic for the first time. Some say it could even happen this decade. And again, departing from this article, from my own comments, I wouldn't be surprised to see that happen this summer. I'd be shocked and horrified, but I wouldn't be surprised. But returning to the article, well, actually, before I return to the article, the reason I say that is not just to be alarmist, but because over the years, passing along this sort of information and trying to integrate it into everything that I can find out or know about global warming, I've noticed that there is an acceleration in such predictions. There's an acceleration in the acceleration of the events in the Arctic and around the globe. And I would say that we are in and past the tipping point. But to return to the article, what makes this event significant is the role Arctic sea ice plays as a reflector of solar energy. Ice is white and therefore reflects a large part of the incoming sunlight back out to space. But where there is no ice, dark ocean water absorbs most of the sunlight and thus heats up. The less ice there is, the more water heats up, melting more ice. This feedback has all kinds of consequences for the Arctic region. Disappearing ice can be good for species such as tiny algae that profit from the warmer waters and extended growing season. But no sea ice could spell catastrophe for larger animals that hunt or give birth to offspring on the ice. Rapidly changing conditions also have repercussions for human populations whose income and culture depend on sea ice. Their communities literally melt and wash away as the sea ice no longer acts as a buffer to weaken wave action. And once again, departing from the article, obviously the absence of sea ice and the greater energy in the pole has caused terrific storms, which go on today. And if you check the news today for storms, you'll see that we are having more of those huge, pardon me, and unusual storms. But they write, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. The rapid disappearance of sea ice cover can have consequences that are felt all over the Northern Hemisphere due to the effects it has on atmospheric patterns. As this ice pack becomes smaller ever earlier into the melting season, more and more sunlight gets soaked up by dark ocean waters, effectively warming up the ocean. The heat and moisture that are then released to the atmosphere in the fall and winter could be leading to disturbances of the jet stream, the high-altitude wind that separates warm air to itself from cold air to the north. A destabilized jet stream, becomes more wavy, allowing frigid air to plunge farther south, a possible factor in the extreme winters that were experienced all around the Northern Hemisphere in recent years. Another side effect is that as the jet stream waves become larger, they slow down or even stall at times, leading to a significant increase in so-called blocking events. And departing from the text, they're talking about droughts there. Now, I have some more to pass on this, but I want to call this the climate emergency. I believe we are past the tipping point here. I think it's pretty obvious. If you look at the jet stream and compare it to Superstorm Sandy and Superstorm Nemo, and the current events, you'll see that these huge dips in the circumpolar winds indeed are affecting the climate. And I see it as my job to look at the science. Scientists, of course, are very conservative in what they say, and they don't project what they feel or sometimes even what is obvious to their capacity for projection into the future, because it's their job to look at exactly what's happening and to give you what can absolutely be deduced from whatever they are focused on at the time, which is great. I want them to be that way. My job is to look at this and say, oh my God, this has gone way, way too far. I see it as my job to look at the body of evidence and say, we have to do something about this politically. I do have a suggestion. When you're up in the mountains, it's sometimes helpful to have a wool cloak with you. There's various types of covering you can have, of course, to deal with the climate. But if you've ever been hiking and you're up at altitude and you're in that time of the year where most things are melted out, but not everything, you know that you need that wool cloak and that hood to keep the sun from just roasting you at certain times during the day. And you pull it over your head. And you might have a little cool air going on, but the sun is just way too hot, and so it's nice to have that hood over your head. And then if you go into a shaded area, say under trees or in a outcrop or cave or something, well, then you use that same wool to hold the heat in. The same sort of thing is happening with the earth with cloud cover, and so if you will follow me in this extension, this little metaphor, the cloud cover can be the wool coating for the earth, a little bit of fluffy white wool, if you like. And when the sun hits the clouds because of the albedo, because of the reflectivity of the clouds, because of that bright whiteness, sun rays, the heating sun rays, some of them get bounced off back into space. When the clouds aren't there, the sun can act. And likewise, when the clouds aren't there, the Earth can cool itself. Now, here's the relevant information. On September 12, 2011, airline traffic over the United States was stopped. I could go into that whole scene. I thought it was ridiculous, and I think the whole thing is a fraud. But the fact is, airline traffic was stopped, and an interesting thing happened. The effect of airline contrails became obvious in a way that could not otherwise have been measured, and it turned out to be just like that wool cloak. During the day, airline contrails, as you know, if you watch them, those half-burned petroleum compounds go out, mix up with ice crystals, and they spread. And it turns out they have quite an impact on solar heating. They spread out and they block sunlight, but at night they spread out and they block the cooling of the Earth. They hold the heat into the Earth just like that wool cloak would. And so they're doing both. During the day, they're blocking some sunlight. And the reason we know this is because the temperatures were higher during the day when there was no contrails from aircraft. And conversely, the temperatures measured on September 12th and subsequent days were much lower at night. I say much lower, but I mean geologically speaking, they were just quite significantly lower, a degree or so. Because that heat was radiating out into space where it hadn't been able to before because of the constant presence of airline and military aircraft contrails. Well, this suggests a method of global cooling, a geoengineering method. And before I go a little further with that, I think it's terrible that conditions have gotten to the point where to save our lives, we need to resort to geoengineering. What we need to do is stop. Degree of airline traffic cannot be sustained, obviously. There should be other, and this is the 21st century. There are other swift ways to travel. This should not be happening. But because it is happening and because the powers that be are the powers that be, I suggest the following. At the very, very, very minimum, there should be no aircraft flights creating contrails over the North Pole at night. They happen during the day, that blocks heat, that's good for us for right now. But if they happen at night, they hold the heat in. And we are in, as I was saying, the clathrate gun climate emergency. Coming up this summer, there will be a risk of even more methane bursting out from the areas where the ice was melted off. A lot of this came from just the water where the microbes have made methane. But of course, there is the frozen clathrates and the methane that is locked into the soil could come bursting out. And the consequences of that are, as I was saying, greatly increased global warming. But also, if enough of it comes out at once, it creates an anoxic cloud. It's kind of can't really just keep on living when you don't have any oxygen to breathe if you get into one of those clouds, which haven't happened yet. That's a bit of a projection. But the fact that these 1,400 to 1,700 gigatons of carbon are starting to move is a fact. So this is my suggestion. Ban cross-polar flights at night. And I'm calling this, for lack of a better term, contrail climate remediation. Now, that's an easily reversed and easily scalable geoengineering strategy. And because it is an emergency, this is what I suggest. And I suggest it to you on this tiny little radio station. And I put this in your lap. Something needs to be done immediately, today, right now. And this is an emergency. This does threaten life on Earth. And you know someone who would be interested in this idea. And so you should talk to someone. I have sent a letter, it's been a couple of years now, to Dr. James Hansen of NASA. Trying to talk about this, I have not received a response, but it is the only currently instantly producible program that could cool the ice caps and restore the ice. And the other thing I wanted to say about the ice is not only was half or more than half of it missing, but it is 80% thinned. This is a terrific and ongoing crisis. Turning to realclimate.org, where methane levels above the Arctic Ocean are relatively low, there still may be very high levels of methane underneath the sea ice that are still broken down by bacteria. Dr. Malcolm Light has the following comments about the images I was talking about, the images of methane mapped over the missing sea ice areas. He writes, "The first image clearly shows that the westerly Svalbard branch of the Gulf Stream must be destabilizing methane hydrates between Norway and Svalbard. The effects of the eastern Yermak branch of the Gulf Stream, which enters the Barents Sea, clearly seen in these graphics. And they're being destabilized by the heat it's bringing in. All this extra heating of the Gulf Stream causing increased evaporation is the reason for giant flooding that has been seen in Europe. And the water clouds are preventing the ocean from losing its heat efficiently, so the Yermak and Svalbard branches of the Gulf Stream can still destabilize the methane hydrates even in the dead of winter." So talking about those high methane levels. And they go on to say that there's little correlation between the methane and the depth of the ocean. Okay, you're listening to Press Watch, and coming up, we're going to have Per Fagering talking about Pope John Paul I. Pope John Paul I, remember him? I think it's important to keep track of our history. Gives us ideas of what's going on at the Vatican. And last week I said I was running for Pope, and I'm glad to say that I got some online encouragement there. You can find Press Watch on Facebook, and I encourage you to... Oh, now I've forgotten. Either you like it or you friend it, or so do a Facebook thing to Press Watch on Facebook, please. And real quickly, just before I go, another headline. Free Syrian Army hasn't even close to finish with its goal of taking over Syria, but the rebel faction is looking to move into cross-border entanglements the next few days, threatening attacks on Lebanon. If Hezbollah doesn't back off on their border dispute, Hezbollah is... Shia connected with Iran and Syria. The dispute on the Syria-Lebanon border has been growing over the past few days, with Hezbollah and FSA fighters killing one another in disputes over a number of border villages. So keep your eye on that. And stay tuned for more of the incomparable Radio Zine with Per Fagering coming up.
Gareth from Music from the True Vine, inviting you to Once in a Boo Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs. My fellow Music from the True Vine hosts and I will be performing as the True Vine Ramblers and bringing you a great set of traditional bluegrass music. Other acts include Henry and Moggy doing some down-home ragtime and country, Don McLaren and his fiddlin' friends striking up some old-time fiddle tunes, and Noontime Jamboree host Retta Christie and her one-night stand band performing some swing. Once in a Boo Moon is on Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church from 7 to 10 p.m. Doors open at 6 p.m., so plan on arriving early, as ticket prices also include desserts with coffee or tea. There will also be a silent auction and raffle items to view. For full details, go to the KBOO website at kboo.fm. and click on Once in a Boo Moon under Coming Events. All proceeds...
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagering, and the show is Fight the Empire. And today we're going to talk about Pope John Paul I. My guest, hopefully, will be David Yollop. And he is a British investigative writer. He's written books about various crimes. The Day the Laughter Stopped, which is a biography of Fatty Arbuckle. I don't know if people remember him. Big star back in the 20s. Beyond Reasonable Doubt about the or the Deliver Some Evil about the Yorkshire Ripper. Anyway, David Yallop is based in England, and we're trying to get him right now on the phone. But he wrote a book called In God's Name, An Investigation into the Murder of Pope John Paul I. And that book came out, I believe, in 1984, and I think it's been updated since. But it's really a book worth reading. I don't know. I hope it's still in print. This is a paperback book that I have. And check it out. Check it out. See if Powell's has it. See if the library has it. It's really a book worth worth reading. Anyway, while we're waiting to get our guest, let's talk about Pope John Paul I. A lot of people don't remember him. Everybody remembers John Paul II, Karol Wojtyla, the Polish pope. You know, he's pope for a long time, traveled around a lot, very charismatic guy. But he was preceded by Pope John Paul I, who's an Italian named Albino Luciani. And he was pope in 1978, and he was only pope for 33 days, and then he died in September 1978. As far as people know, he was in good health. He was not an old guy. I think he was in his 60s, and he was known as a smiling pope. He's a very humble guy. He really believed in the Church of the Poor, and he was really inspired by Pope John Paul the 23rd, who was the one who convened the Second Vatican Council and had a lot to do with liberation theology in Latin America. And John Paul the First was inspired by John the 23rd, and also by Paul the Sixth, who came immediately before him. Paul the Sixth is sort of an int-